All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going deep on something that sounds, I'll be honest, a little bit niche.
Niche is a good word for it.
Concept protocols in clinical trial design.
Yeah.
Now stick with us here, folks, because even if you're not out there designing these trials yourself, understanding this early stage, it really has a huge impact on how quickly new treatments actually reach patients.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for this deep dive, we're really tapping into the knowledge of a clinical project management team that has, like, decades of experience writing these concept protocols and the full protocol.
The real deal.
The real deal. And then we're also going to touch on how technology is starting to shape all of this.
Yeah, definitely seeing some interesting developments there.
So, okay, our mission today is to really break down concept protocols. Like, what are they? And maybe even more importantly, why do they even matter?
All right.
And then we'll look at what makes a good one and, you know, maybe touch on some of the new tools that are changing how they're even made.
It's like a peek behind the curtain of how these big medical research studies really begin.
Right. So, I mean, you know, the listener might be thinking concept protocols sounds kind of technical. And to be honest, it is, right?
Yeah.
But think of it this way. Every amazing building, before you even see it, starts with some kind of like sketch or a blueprint.
The initial vision.
Right. And that's what the concept protocol is. It's like the blueprint, that early sketch for a clinical trial. And by understanding this step, it gives you, the listener, a sense of like the whole journey a new drug or treatment actually goes through. And it might even explain why some trials move so fast while others just seem to hit all these roadblocks.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. What are these concept protocols?
So they're short, flexible documents. Really, you can think of them as capturing the initial, the very first ideas for how you want to structure your clinical study. The goal isn't to create the be-all, end-all plan right away, but it's more about getting everyone talking, making sure the research team is all on the same page about the big things before you sink a ton of time and energy into that really comprehensive full protocol.
So like a first draft, but intentionally kind of rough around the edges.
Exactly. They're supposed to be, you know, quick to read and, most importantly, easy to change and edit. And this is really important because in the early stages, designs can change a lot and you got to be able to adapt. And, you know, one question we see pop up a lot and our sources emphasize this is how many drafts should we even have? And the advice from this team with all the experience, don't get bogged down in tiny details just yet. Focus on the big picture.
Right. Yeah. Like, don't worry about the perfect wording when you're still figuring out what the study's even about.
Exactly. And to stay focused on that big picture, these documents, they tend to be pretty short, about 6 to 8 pages, usually. If they're much longer, you start to lose that speed and flexibility that makes them so valuable.
They got to be lightweight. Right. So you can get that initial agreement quickly.
Yeah.
And that sounds really different from the full protocols we hear about, you know, which seems super detailed.
Oh, they are. Full protocols are incredibly comprehensive. And because of that, they take a lot of time to write and review. And it's actually a little concerning, but the process of getting those full protocols finished, well, it's not always the most efficient. Our sources actually point to this stat. Nearly 60% of full protocols end up needing at least one big amendment. And almost half of those 45%, they were totally preventable.
Wow. So that's a lot of time and resources potentially wasted. So this concept protocol thing, it's about preventing those issues early on, right?
Absolutely. And that leads us to the why, the real value of these initial steps.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest advantages, and this project management team really emphasizes this, is that concept protocols force the team to get aligned early on. And I don't just mean agreeing with each other. It's about finding those conflicting assumptions, those places where people's ideas might clash before you've already invested tons of resources. Like, you know, if the team's planning this super complex patient monitoring schedule, but the budget can't handle it, the concept protocol is where you catch that.
It's like, get everyone on the same page about the basics before you start building the fancy house, right?
Right. And it lets a team zero in on the most crucial parts of the design right from the start. And that means you're way more likely to find potential problems early when they're actually fixable.
So it's like catching that design flaw in your blueprint rather than when you've already poured the foundation, right?
Exactly. And when you have that early alignment and focus, it makes developing the full protocol so much smoother. When everyone agrees on the basics, drafting the details is way more efficient.
Yeah, everyone knows where they're going, so you don't have to constantly revisit those big decisions. Now, what about actually running the trial? Do concept protocols help there too?
They do. By laying out those key points clearly, it becomes easier for everyone involved, including the sites that are actually running the trial, to understand the main goals. And that means less back and forth, less confusion when you're trying to put the plan into action.
So clearer communication at the beginning leads to smoother sailing later on. And you mentioned cutting out unnecessary complexity. How does the concept protocol help with that?
Well, because the focus is on the essentials, it automatically forces you to trim away all that nice-to-have stuff, all those extra procedures that might sneak into the full protocol. You have to really focus on the core objectives and what you absolutely need to achieve them.
Okay, so we've got the what and the why of concept protocols, but what actually goes in one of these things? What are the essential parts of that, like, 6 to 8 page document?
Our sources suggest starting with a template. Or maybe the synopsis from a full protocol template, or even request a specific concept protocol template if you can.
Makes sense. Start with a framework.
Right. But regardless of the template, there are a few key sections that got to be there. First, you need a background study rationale. This is where you explain the why behind the study. You know, why is it even being done? What's the need? You introduce the investigational product, what's being tested, and how this study fits into its overall development plan. Really, you're setting the scene, explaining why this research is important.
Laying the groundwork before you dive into the details. Okay, what comes next?
Next up, you've got your objectives. This is where you state what you're actually trying to find out. And it's super important, our sources say, to only have one primary objective. That's the single most important question you're trying to answer. You might have secondary objectives, additional things you're looking at, and maybe even exploratory objectives, which are more about, you know, generating new questions for future research.
Got it. So a hierarchy of goals. Now, how do you know if you've actually achieved those objectives?
That's where endpoints come in. These are specific, measurable things that tell you if you've hit your target. For each of those objectives, that main question and the other ones you need defined endpoints that will show if you succeeded. They have to be measurable and directly linked back to your objectives.
Okay, you got to know what you're measuring to track your progress. Makes sense. Now, what about how the study's actually going to be done?
That goes in the study design section. It should be a concise overview, no more than a couple of paragraphs, unless the study is super complex, like if it has multiple phases. Our sources suggest using visuals here. Things like a study flow diagram can really help when you have a complex design, like to show the different treatment groups or how the placebo is used. This section also includes things like when and why the study might be stopped, rules for participants withdrawing, and any planned adjustments to the study based on what you find along the way.
Okay, so keep it clear with visuals, especially when the procedures get complicated. Got it. What about who can actually be in the study?
Right, that's the study population section. This is where you lay out your inclusion and exclusion criteria. Who can participate and who can't? It's a balancing act, as the source points out. Strict criteria can give you a more specific group, which is helpful for analysis, but it can also make it way harder to actually find enough participants.
Right. Got to make sure you can actually get people enrolled.
Exactly.
Okay. And what about the actual treatment itself? What's being tested?
That's in the investigational product intervention section. You got to give all the key details about what the treatment is, how it differs between groups in the study, how it's given, the dosage, how often, and the form. Is it a pill, an injection, stuff like that?
Right. All the nitty-gritty details about what's actually going to the participants. And then you need to figure out how you're going to handle all that data you'll collect.
Definitely. That's the statistics data analysis section. This is where you explain the reasoning behind your stats approach. You know, how are you going to prove your hypothesis? This includes your plan for analyzing the primary endpoint data, details on how you figured out your sample size, and what you're going to do with any secondary or exploratory endpoints.
Okay. The math behind the medicine.
Exactly.
And last but not least, how do you keep track of all the different assessments and procedures that happen during the study?
Ah, that's where study assessments come in. The best way to present this is usually a time and events table. It basically lays out visually every procedure and when it happens throughout the study. Footnotes can give a bit more detail on specific procedures, but if it's a really complex schedule, especially on those super busy days, multiple tables might be easier to understand.
So it's almost like a calendar for the entire study showing what happens when.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's what should be in there. Now, what about things that teams should try to avoid putting into concept protocols?
Oh, that's important. Our sources say avoid anything that's just nice to have, you know, things that aren't absolutely necessary for understanding the core design. No need for standard paragraphs or text that you usually see in full protocols, but that aren't super critical for the concept.
So keep it lean, focused on the must-haves.
Right. and no need for specific lists of study sites. It's fine to mention the region or country if there are only a few options, but detailed lists come later. And don't get bogged down in procedural or operational details, you know, stuff like step-by-step instructions for a specific test. Those belong in a separate manual, not the protocol, and especially not in the concept protocol. Those manuals don't need the same level of regulatory approval and can be changed easier if needed.
Yeah, no point sweating the details of how to draw blood when you're still deciding if you even need blood samples in the first place. Anything else to avoid?
Oh, yeah. Our source talks about this interesting thing. The urge to add extra procedures or collect more data just in case you need it later. It seems harmless, but a FISAI analysis actually found that this kind of data overload can really slow down trials. So stick to what's essential for your main objectives and avoid collecting too much data at this stage.
So less is more in the early stages. Now, you mentioned before that concept protocols are great for sparking discussion within the team. What are some key areas where teams should be asking questions and really digging deep during this concept development phase?
Oh yeah, this is where the team really comes together, as our source puts it. When you're looking at the background study rationale, teams should really discuss things like, is this investigational product similar to other compounds we know about? What are the potential safety concerns? Are these concerns related to how the drug works? Are they common with similar drugs, or are they unique to this one? And what do we already know about how it behaves in humans? Or if it's the first time in humans, what can we reasonably guess based on animal studies? How's the body going to process it?
So understand the context and potential risks from the get-go. What about the study population? What questions should the team be asking there?
For the study population, it's really important to think about how easy it will be to actually find enough people who fit the criteria. Can we realistically recruit enough participants? And can we target specific groups who might respond better to the treatment based on what we know?
Makes sense. Focus your recruitment efforts where you're most likely to see results.
Right. Mm.
Now, what about when you're figuring out the investigational product intervention, especially the dose?
Dose selection is crucial. The team should really be grilling each other. Is there enough preclinical data to support the starting dose for humans? And for those first-in-human trials, you need to really scrutinize how that initial dose was calculated. Techniques like allometric scaling, they can be unreliable for some drugs. And how do those higher doses in the study relate to what we saw in animals? Do we need to find the maximum tolerated dose in humans? Even justifying the use of a single dose in later studies needs to be talked about.
So many factors to consider when you're trying to find that sweet spot between effectiveness and safety. Now, what about the range of doses you test?
When it comes to the dose range, ask yourselves, will this study actually tell us how people respond to different doses? Do those chosen doses cover a meaningful range? And does the design let us see both the good and the bad effects across that range? Remember, people react differently to the same dose.
So don't just pick doses randomly. Really think about what you're trying to learn across the spectrum. What about the study assessments?
For assessments, the focus should be on whether the planned measurements are valid and reliable for those specific endpoints you defined. And of course, you have to ask, are we doing enough to monitor safety? Can we effectively catch and manage any potential problems?
Safety first, always. Makes perfect sense. And finally, what kind of discussion should be happening around the statistics data analysis early on?
The reasons behind your sample size and the specific statistical methods you're going to use, those are big ones.
Yeah.
You also need to consider how much a complex protocol with tons of measurements will cost. And think about the chances of finding unexpected things from tests that aren't even related to your main objectives. Do we have the resources to investigate those further? Do we even need to?
Okay, so think practically. Think about the budget and think about those what-if scenarios. Now, the world of clinical trials is always changing, and tech is playing a bigger and bigger role. How is all of that starting to impact how these concept protocols are created?
Oh, for sure. Advanced technology is changing things. Our sources point to these large language models, LLMs, as a growing trend. People are using them to draft the initial versions of protocols.
AI stepping into the world of clinical trials. Interesting.
Yeah. These tools are being tested for their ability to standardize those repetitive sections of a protocol, like the inclusion-exclusion criteria, or the language around side effects. They can also help make sure the language you use is in line with the latest guidelines.
Right.
The hope is that this can really speed up the initial drafting process, freeing up human experts for the more strategic, complex parts of the design.
Okay, so AI handling the grunt work so the humans can focus on the big picture. But are there any downsides to using AI like this?
Well, while the early results in those pilot programs look promising, our sources are careful to point out that we don't have a ton of real-world data on how successful this is long-term, especially across different types of clinical trials. It's still early days, and we need more evidence to be sure these tools can handle all the twists and turns that come with clinical trial protocols.
So still being tested, what are some specific limitations that have come up so far?
Well, some studies and case reports have shown some positive results, but they also point to potential problems, like these AI models might miss subtle but important regulatory details or clinical considerations that really need a human eye and a human brain. Agencies like the FDA and EMA are still saying loud and clear that human oversight is critical for every stage of development. So for now, it seems like LLMs are more of a helper for human experts, not a replacement. The general advice is, be careful using LLMs for drafting, and keep good records of how you use them, what permissions you might need, and all that.
So, a potentially helpful assistant, but not ready to take over just yet. Human expertise is still vital.
100%. And that brings us back to the key takeaway and some good practices for creating concept protocols. The main goal is to design a study that's scientifically found and also practical and efficient to actually run.
And one trap to avoid is getting stuck in endless revisions, right?
Exactly. Don't waste time with draft after draft of tiny changes or adding things that aren't essential. Our project management experts recommend having a face-to-face meeting early on to finalize the core elements. Focus that meeting on the overall strategy and the key scientific and operational points. Don't get sidetracked by minor details or wording.
Big picture first, then fine-tune later. And the goal of all this is to make drug development faster, right?
That's it. When you have a solid concept protocol, developing the full, detailed one should be much smoother and faster, which means treatments get to patients quicker.
So to sum up for our listeners, these concept protocols, they might seem like internal documents for researchers, but they're actually super important. They're the first step in designing good clinical trials. By focusing on the essentials early on and getting everyone on the same page, you avoid delays and expensive changes later, which means potentially life-saving treatments reach people sooner.
Absolutely. And one final thought. Think about how this idea of a concise concept document could be used in other complex projects too, not just clinical trials. Starting with clear objectives and focusing on efficiency from the beginning is valuable in a lot of fields.
That's a great point. If this deep dive into clinical trial design has you intrigued, there are tons of resources out there from regulatory bodies and universities that can give you even more info. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.